Good morning on this Labor Day weekend, the last weekend of summer in most people's minds, and the last Sunday edition in the summer. I'm Karen Wells, sitting in for Michael Enright. Everyone has images from their childhood, moments of wonder and incredulity that never fade away. When I was 8, I was taken to see the salmon run in the Adams River near Kamloops, B.C. That river that day was packed from bank to bank with blood-red fish, salmon slowly dying now that they had fought their way up the river and laid their eggs. These big runs happen every 4 years, I was told as I stood on the bank of that river. More salmon than you can imagine coming back to B.C. But over the years, the fish stopped coming back in their old numbers. Doom and gloom prevailed until this year, when, much to everyone's surprise, over 30 million fish showed up. But why in the name of science did it come as such a surprise? We'll have a conversation about the mysteries of fish forecasting. We'll also bring back an interview that Michael did with journalist-novelist Anna Quinlan. After a brilliant career as a columnist with both the New York Times and Newsweek, Anna Quinlan began an equally brilliant career as a novelist. The novels began several years ago. Her latest book, Every Last One, continues her exploration of that most interesting of topics, everyday life. And then in the second hour, Fourth Line Theatre in rural Ontario, the little theatre that thought it could and did. Many nights, it's standing room only. The plays at Fourth Line are written by some of the best Canadian playwrights, and they spring from the Ontario soil. This year, they had the Port Hope play about Canada's uranium industry and the Right Road to Pontypool, a vacation spot of a bygone era for working-class Jews. The Sunday edition in the summer on CBC Radio 1. About 10 days ago, forecasters were predicting that 25 million salmon would return to the Fraser River this year. The next day, that prediction was up to 30 million. By early this week, it was 34 million, the biggest run in almost 100 years. If you go down to the docks, you'll find that fishermen are practically giving salmon away for $4 a pound, 20 bucks for an entire fish. And it's not just the Fraser. Sockeye runs all over the West Coast are running at 200 to 300% higher than predicted. The fish are back. Fish canneries don't have the capacity to handle that many fish. Up and down the coast, they are working overtime, and they still can't keep up. This is a very different picture from what we saw last year. Last year, the feeling was we were on the verge of catching the very last fish in the world, and that we had overexploited the natural bounty of the sea for 100 years, and it was now payback time. Your local bookstore is still stocked with a library of books with gloomy titles, The End of the Line, How Overfishing is Changing the World and What We Eat, Seasick, The Global Ocean in Crisis, The Empty Ocean. One of the contributions to that genre is written by one of my next guests. Dean Bavington is a professor of environmental history at Nipissing University in North Bay, Ontario, where he is now. His book is called Managed Annihilation, An Unnatural History of the Newfoundland Cod Collapse. It's published by UBC Press. And in Vancouver, I've reached Daniel Pauly. Dr. Pauly is a professor at the Fisheries Centre of the University of BC and the principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project. That's a project devoted to studying the impact of fisheries on the world's marine ecosystems. We've reached them both on Skype. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Daniel Pauly, can I ask you, do we really know how many fish are coming up the Fraser River from year to year or will come up? Can we figure it out?
Well, we know when they do.
Yeah.
I should preface the all I say by the fact that they continue to be in dire strait, they continue to be in bad shape, and the books that you have cited are certainly not invalidated by the presence of more salmon than predicted.
Fair enough. But help me with that basic question. Why did we think so few were coming and then so many came?
Clearly, everybody is scrambling to cover their behind right now, and nobody has predicted that. But in formal term, the precision of prediction is never great. And what we have now is a rare event, but a possible event of prediction. So this is, we have here to deal with a difficult system. This is a more difficult system than, for example, cod, that is within reach of certain of the fisheries all the time.
So you mean there are a lot of different variables when we're talking about salmon. You mean everything from the rivers
That's
to...
That's right. Okay. This is what in science would be called a difficult problem.
And I guess it's a difficult problem for everyone.
That's the reason why the prediction concerning other fisheries and the description in various books are roughly correct. We are really going down to hell with our fisheries. But salmon, what we have in salmon is an enormous variability. And we have to separate this variability that occurs and that can be shown to have always occurred from trends that are prevailing and that cannot be discussed away. For example, the disappearance of little runs from little rivers. That is a sure thing. There are lots of little rivers that don't yield any salmon anymore. This large salmon run that we see now coming just from a few river and a few lakes in a few rivers.
So, Dean Bevington, I mean, would you say that this, the 34 million or however many it is salmon who are returning to the Fraser River this year, is this false optimism?
Well, yeah, I think this, I want to pick up on a point that Professor Pauly made about variability. I think the important point here to focus on is how annual fluctuations in landings or in expected landings of fisheries change from year to year. So we're seeing now on the West Coast with the salmon runs, and we're also seeing in particular bays around Newfoundland this year in the food fishery, some strong or unexpected returns in particular bays and locations. But overall, the overall trend is, as Dr. Pauly was saying, is definitely a downward trend in stocks worldwide. However, I think it's important here to look at how we deal with these variations from year to year. These are going to continue, and if anything, the spread between yearly runs in fisheries is going to increase. And how we deal with that presently is to see it as a bonanza and to capitalize on it immediately, as opposed to seeing these yearly fluctuations in landings as something that we need to adapt to on an annual basis.
Daniel Pauly, let me ask you, you have written that the world's oceans have been victims of a giant Ponzi scheme. I mean, that implies massive manipulation. And explain what you meant by that, if you would.
A Ponzi scheme is essentially not drawing from the interest of a profitable investment, but from drawing from the capital itself. That is essentially what happens in a Ponzi scheme, from the capital of that people have invested. Then we can see that the fisheries of the world have not drawn from the interest, from the natural growth of the fish, of the fish stocks, but that has fished out the fish stocks one after the other. And this manifested itself in an expansion of fishing throughout the world. And now it's almost stopped because we are fishing everywhere.
I was out this summer with some herring fishermen in the Bay of Fundy, and they were telling me that science was telling them if they fished 20% of the biomass, they would maintain a sustainable fishery. So the problem, though,
yeah,
is...
I understand.
But the problem is, what's the biomass? You know, how many fish are there in the sea?
If you don't know that, you what you think is 20% can be 50%. If you don't know exactly the biomass, the percentage that you think is a low percentage, is a low interest rate, and it's going to work, is going to be too high, and you're going to eliminate that biomass. Then you're forced to move on to another species and to that is further offshore. And this is precisely what happened in the evolution of industrial fisheries from the end of the 19th century on. And that's the reason why I can say with certainty that fisheries have not been sustainable. And this is exactly like a Ponzi scheme, because at the Ponzi scheme will continue. You can pay the so-called investor, the old ones, with new money from the new ones, so long as you get new investors. And when no new investors come in, the whole scheme collapses. And we have that exactly happening now, where the fisheries of the world have reached the end of the world, which is in the South Pacific and the South Atlantic. This is Antarctica. And they are fishing in Antarctica, but they cannot go further. They cannot go further south.
Because they're at the end of the world.
At this point, that's the end of the world. They fall off. Yeah. And at this point, the fisheries catches decline. And it is not by accident that we could show that in the late 80s was the peak catches of the world. The world right now has a declining catch.
Help me with one thing, though. Can we go back to this question of, you know, what percentage of the fish in the sea is sustainable? Because if we say, for instance, in the case of herring, it's 20%, do fish scientists, predictors, know enough to determine exactly what that 20% is, you know, looking at what's happened with the predictions this year?
I would say we can assume that this percentage is correct, but you cannot exactly force the fishes to catch exactly what they catch. They catch generally more than they are supposed to. This is called quota busting. In most fisheries of the world, there are no quota. And further, in many countries where there is a quota, that quota is not set by the scientists, but by the politician. In Europe, all quota are set not by scientists, but by politicians who boost the percentage that the scientists propose for political reason.
Well, and I think I can also come in here with the Newfoundland is a very good example of where you have fisheries scientists in management organizations in 1992 setting the quota at 285,000 tons. The industrial fishing fleets going out to try and find that fish and not being able to catch any of the quota. So and what we also have in Newfoundland is a very good example of different ways of knowing fish, because prior to the collapse of the fishery, inshore fishermen using non-industrial, not the draggers offshore, but inshore small-scale fishermen were claiming there was a problem, that the quotas manipulated, yes, by politicians, but also produced by scientific quantitative models, were claiming that there was lots of fish to catch when they were seeing themselves out on the water, no fish, no cod to catch in inshore waters. After 1992 and recently, the fisheries models are claiming that there are no fish anymore. Fishery scientists increasingly are saying cod needs to be declared an endangered species. And inshore fishermen, people who are participating in the small-scale food fishery, are going out and experiencing some years very bad, other years very good. And we come to this conclusion, or we come to a situation where we have to ask, you know, who the public is asking, who should I listen to? Should we listen to fishermen who, when they're operating industrial tools, as Daniel Pauly was mentioning, doesn't matter how ethical the captain is. When you're using industrial tools, you cannot help but catch other species of fish. And what's interesting to note is that before scientific fisheries management was applied in Newfoundland, there was a sense of what appropriate fishing technologies were in Newfoundland for cod. And it was always single hook with a piece of bait on the end, capelin usually, or herring, cut up, and put into the water, and cod would come and feed on this when they were hungry. They would go for the bait, following in their natural prey species, the capelin, from offshore grounds. And the fishery would end when cod were full, glutted full of capelin, and would lie logy on the bottom and wouldn't go for any bait. And what would happen then is the fishery would stop and cod fishermen would do something else. What happens after the Second World War is that way of fishing is purposely destroyed by government policy to get rid of inshore small-scale fleets and move to a large-scale capital-intensive offshore fishing industries alongside with people instead of working outside drying cod as part of a family, moving inside to fish plants and adopting wage work.
So the entire method changes and creates with it all sorts of additional problems.
And yes, and that the fishermen originally, when these new technologies, when the baited hook and line technology was being replaced by other technologies, not the dragger right away, but initially something called a cod jigger, which is just an image of a capelin fish, not the actual fish, but just a lead weight image with lots of hooks on it, that after cod were full and wouldn't go for bait, you could just drop this jigger down and start catching cod in the side, in the eye, in the tail, whatever, and haul them on board. This technology is introduced by merchants to continue fishing beyond what's appropriate.
Dean Babington, can I take you back to the salmon on the BC coast and this amazing sight of 34 million fish coming up the Fraser this year? I mean, what is, if you like, the lesson or the moral of the great salmon run of 2010?
What I take from this is that we cannot decide how to interact with fish, whether it's cod on the East Coast or salmon on the West Coast, solely by relying on scientific models that have huge error ranges that allow for politicians to dictate what quotas are from year to year, really based on these models with large error ranges, what Daniel Pauly was talking about. So instead, what I think the lesson should be is that we need to understand the history of these fisheries, and in particular on the West Coast, the indigenous populations that managed to live with these species without any scientific management for years.
And so you're saying deindustrialize.
I'm saying not only deindustrialize, but change our whole how decisions are made in Canada around fisheries and move it as far away from the fisheries minister in Ottawa as possible and as close to the ground with both scientists and fishermen and other people who are out actually studying, experiencing fish and oceans as opposed to solely studying quantitative models.
So you're saying listen to the fishermen
Basically listen to the fishermen a bit more and listen to those fishermen who have proven through history to be able to interact with fish in a way that allows for the continuation of fish and fish and fisher people, as opposed to the industrial model we have now that hasn't been able to sustain fish and fishing people any more than maximum 50 years.
Daniel Pauly, I'm interested in what you take from this salmon run this year. I mean, because you're sitting in BC where the Cohen Commission is looking at, the government commission is looking into the paucity of salmon, and yet you've got this 34 million fish. I mean, there's a PR problem here, is there not?
I wouldn't like to be in their shoes, that for sure, because investigating the paucity of fish with the background of an excess of them is must be a nightmare. Also, I think it's a bit early to draw a conclusion because the lessons have not all come in. I think there is lots of sense in what Dean Babington says about making the fishery response more to the actors that are on the ground and less in to Ottawa.
Thank you both very much. I appreciate this conversation to try and understand this salmon run in BC and what we've been looking at. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Professors Dean Bavington and Daniel Pauley. Dean Bavington is a professor of environmental history at Nipissing University in North Bay, Ontario, and the author of the recently released book, Managed Annihilation, An Unnatural History of the Newfoundland Cod Collapse. Daniel Pauley is a professor at the Fisheries Center at UBC and the principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project. Dean Bavington was in North Bay, Daniel Pauley in Vancouver.
The winds have turned the sunburned trees, vanilla hills grow brittle coats. A last strong cry to face the winter, rise up from their golden throats. Their songs are leaves upon the water, carried on the river's back. The current draws them fiercely under, the season of their beauty gone. A flash of red, the waters churn, against the flow a steady burn. Life has come, death's on its turn. The salmon run, run, salmon run. Russet, ruddy, raw and weary, school of driven fools of fury, against eastbound enemy, on to glory land. Homes a smell on foreign water, coming closer every bend. Courage wavering, hoping ever for glimpses of remembered land. A flash of red, the waters churn, against the flow a steady burn. Life has come, death's on its turn. The salmon run, run, salmon run. Gather strength like songs in baskets, summer petals, autumn leaves. Join the fools against the current, journey on to glory land. A flash of red, the waters churn, against the flow a steady burn. Life has come, death's on its turn. The salmon run, run, salmon run. A flash of red, the waters churn, against the flow a steady burn. Life has come, death's on its turn. The salmon run, run, salmon run. The salmon run, run, salmon run. The salmon run, salmon run, salmon run.
A nice little bit of a cappella singing. That was a group called As the Crow Flies with a song called Salmon Run. You're listening to the Sunday edition on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Karen Wells. It's been a little over a year since Anna Quindlen wrote her last regular column for Newsweek magazine. In that column, she explained that it was time for fresh perspective and new ideas. After 9 years as the bi-weekly back page columnist, she was stepping aside to make room for younger writers. But really, she's chosen to do full-time what she's always wanted to do, make things up. It's not the first time that Anna Quindlen has left journalism. In 1995, she quit the New York Times, where she'd won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary, to concentrate on writing her novels full-time. Her career, her word work, as she calls it, spans almost 40 years, and her work has appeared in some of America's most influential newspapers and magazines. Then, as now, journalism's loss has been fiction's gain. Ms. Quindlen has written 14 books, including 4 best-selling novels, Object Lessons, One True Thing, Black and Blue, and Blessings. Her latest novel is called Every Last One. It's the story of an average family, 2 parents, 3 teenagers, a dog, living an average, almost unremarkable life, until something awful happens, and the family is blindsided by an event no one could have predicted. Anna Quindlen spoke to Michael Enright in May.
This is a novel about a family, a particular family. And you once said, I think, that you can't think of anything else to write about except family because they're a metaphor for every other part of society. Tell me what was particular about this family. How did you generate this family?
Well, in some ways, they're not particular. In some ways, they're quite average, I think, in that they have what by most people's lights would be a kind of a charmed life, and yet they have all those little fissures in that kind of charmed life that I think most of us have. You know, the kids are healthy and doing okay in school, but one of them is so downbeat that maybe he's depressed, and the daughter is driven and ambitious and smart, and there was a time a couple of years ago when she didn't eat enough to keep body and soul together. And I think that's what we've discovered about modern life, that there are really happy families that nevertheless have quicksand beneath the bedrock. And that's something that I wanted to explore in this novel.
It's an extraordinary examination of little things, of details, and the accretion of those details make up the life of the family. I know as a journalist you always carried a notebook around with you. Did you do that with the creation of the lathe of the family?
I don't, but my mind has totally taken on that characteristic, and I've got to say it long predates my work in newspapers. My favorite novelist since I was 12 or 13 years old has been Charles Dickens. And the thing that most drew me to him originally was that systematic accretion of small details and how taken together, you know, they made up this complete picture of the debtors' prisons or the slums of London. And that's something that sort of went deep into my writer's DNA from the very beginning. But I do think that in terms of using it, it's reached its zenith with this novel.
The story of the family is told by the mother, Mary Beth Latham. She's a landscape gardener. Her husband's a doctor, and she's devoted to the family. At one point in the novel, she said that we don't have a life. We had children instead. tell me a bit more about her.
Well, I think that she's one of those people who's very invested in her home life. At one point, I think she says that she likes her job just fine, but frankly, one of the best things about it was that she could do it around soccer matches, people who were home from school sick, that kind of thing. And she's sort of good at all different kinds of levels. She's a good friend. I think she's a good mother. She's a good wife. And yet, I think what she realizes is what so many of us realize, which is there's a lot of moving parts to family life. And what can happen is that when you're paying attention to certain of them, others can go awry in ways that you're not totally aware of until perhaps you've reached a critical mass.
Could you have written this particular novel about this particular family if you didn't have a family yourself and didn't have children yourself, do you think?
You know, I don't know. I don't think I could have written this book 20 years ago, which is when, for example, I wrote Object Lessons, which is very much an autobiographical novel, or One True Thing, which is much more written from the standpoint of the daughter rather than the mother. I think I understand something about the mother-child bond and about raising teenagers particularly now that I just didn't understand then. And I also think I just have learned to go deeper into what it means to live and to be human in ways that gave me a level of control and I hope subtlety with this material that I don't think I could have managed, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
When you write about the teenagers and the family, the twins and the young girl in the family, if a writer's going to write about kids, they have to hit the note right in the center. Because if they're off a bit, it'll sound cornball or it won't work. There's one scene where the daughter tells the mother she's thinking of breaking up with her boyfriend. And the mother says, "What?" And the daughter says, "I knew you'd make a big thing out of it. I'm not going to talk to you again." I have those conversations three times a day in my house. And I'm just curious at how you manage to manufacture those.
Well, I have to say the three kids came very easily to me, and in fact, I don't read reviews of my novels anymore. I found
ever
that
you don't nothing?
No, I don't. I don't. I my closest friend vets them for me, and sort of will say, "Yay, you know, the Washington Post or something like that." But one of my acquaintances said to me, "Oh, you got a terrible review in this magazine," which I'm not going to give further publicity to by mentioning its name, and they said that the teenagers were not realistically portrayed in the book, and I just said flatly, that's wrong. Because if there's anything I know about this book, it's that I got the kids. And my oldest son, who is now 26 and a crack grammarian, did the final copy edit on my copy of this. And when he was done, he said to me of his sister, "Oh, I really can't wait to see what Maria's response is to this." And I said, "Why?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, you know, Mary Beth and Ruby, their relationship is so much like yours and Maria's." I said, "Honey, that's not because it's like me and Maria. It's because it's like every woman in her 40s and her 17-year-old daughter."
But capturing the physical description and so on and all of that, but the actual voice, the sound of the teenager, is this something you've got from your kids over the years that it just kind of hung around in your head and somewhere in the frontal lobe and that you were able to retrieve that?
I certainly think that would be a substantial part of it. But the other thing is that after all those years of writing down people's actual quotes in my notebook, either the eavesdropping that I did on the subway train or in parks or schools or things like that, or the direct questions I asked people as a reporter, I think I developed a fairly accurate ear for the way dialogue and character are interrelated. And it's given me more ease with dialogue than with some of the other things that you have to bring to the table when you write a novel. And I don't think this was any different.
Mary Beth says at one point that she has slightly less than an hour each weekday when no one is making demands on her, the soccer games, the dentist appointments, all that. At the same time, her husband, Glenn, who's an ophthalmologist, I think, says that she's too involved in her children's inner lives, that this is a woman who is kind of pulled six different ways.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's pretty typical at this point. And I also think that gender disparity is pretty typical, too, that even men who are really good and involved fathers sometimes feel like their wives take the emotional temperature of their family and their children way more than they need to. I mean, it's how we came up with this term helicopter parenting. And, you know, I think there's a lot more of that going. I mean, I know there's a lot more of it going around. I remember my mother-in-law, who raised six boys, once saying that her standard when they were young was that if nobody was bleeding, they were all right. And I certainly think we've moved far away from that. So I don't think Mary Beth is a hyper parent or a helicopter parent. But I do think that distinction between really overseeing every aspect of daily life and sort of hanging back a little bit is a pretty typical male-female distinction in many households.
You once were quoted, or you in a speech or somewhere, you said that the rigor of raising children ourselves makes clear to us our mother's indelible strength. Did you draw strength from your mother in terms of the way you viewed your children and raised them?
I did later on. I've been working on. I'm going to write a memoir about getting older, about aging, and about the 15 years of life expectancy that we've gained during my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is my mother. And I remember very well as a child going off to school and basically having this niggling feeling that I didn't know what my mother did with herself all day, something that I'm deeply mortified by now. And if she were still living, I would apologize effusively about. But I think, you know, my mother had this gift, which I thought was commonplace at the time, and I think is pretty extraordinary now, and that was that she was really good at kind of unconditional love. And I think that each one of the five of us thought that we were the favorite child. And I try to bring that to the table, or I did every day that I was raising my kids. I tried to be as much like her as a mother as possible, something that I realized over time was somewhat aberrational, since I had some friends who were trying to be as different from their own mothers as possible.
Then the question that comes up from all of that is Mary Beth Anna Quinlan in many ways. And I know this is such a cliche question to ask an author, but is that the case?
She's not, actually. She's much less driven than I am. She's much less hyper than I am. I mean, my attitude towards my work and my focus on my work is a huge part of my character, and that's something that's really missing from her. And in some ways, I think she's a nicer and more reliable person than I am. And in others, I think she's, frankly, a weaker person than I am. I just think in all different kinds of ways we're different from one another. If there's anyone in this novel who bears some resemblance to me, oddly enough, it's Ruby, the 17-year-old daughter who wants to be a writer. I wouldn't say that she's anything like a portrait of myself at 17, but she probably has more of my personality in her than her mother has.
But you always wanted to be a writer, though, didn't you? You always wanted to write fiction. There was something in your yearbook that said that your ambition was to write the great American novel from high school.
I did. It's interesting to watch this in your children, too, because I had other skills and other things I was drawn to. But as time went by, I dropped certain of them. And I watched, for example, my oldest son do that same thing. He was all three of my children acted on a really consistent basis in high school. And I watched number one, who has that kind of driven eldest child personality, drop it in college because he had sussed out the fact that he was a very fine writer and that he was a good actor, but not a great one. And he wanted to do that thing that he thought he was really first rate at. And I think that happened to me pretty early on about writing, that I got so much positive reinforcement from teachers and even from my own family about the things I wrote that I just stuck with it.
My guest this morning is Anna Quinlan. She is the author, most recently, of a novel called Every Last One. It's published by Random House, and this morning she's in our studio in New York. All right, so the family lives an average, ordinary life, quote, more or less. And then about 150 pages in, something dreadful happens. Now, how much do you want to talk about this? Is there a spoiler alert, or should we mention what happens, or what?
I'm really sensitive to this, especially with radio interviews, because uh-huh. I feel like we sound so obtuse talking about this book, at the same time that I do really feel like a novel is a journey, and you don't want to say to somebody, oh, and up around that corner, you're going
to page 163.
You know, that sort of thing.
Let's try and get around it this way.
Last
fall, I interviewed Laurie Moore about her novel, A Gate at the Stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific book.
And wonderful, wonderful writer.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Something happens in that book. And we didn't want to talk about that too much, but we did talk about the effect it had on her in writing it.
Okay.
And I want to ask you now, this extraordinary thing happens. It shook me. It must have shaken you.
Terrible. I mean, both of my sons are fiction writers, and I do some of my most concentrated work during the summers and at a farm we own out in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. And two summers ago, all of us were out there. The two boys were working on their novels, and I was working on mine. And for about a week, I kept saying, I can't write this chapter. I just can't write this chapter. It's just too upsetting to me. It's as though I'm going to make something bad happened to these wonderful people. And after about 4 or 5 days, my second son Christopher said, Mom, just stop. Just go up there today and sit down at your desk in your little writing hut and just pound it out. And sure enough, because in some ways writing dramatic, highly dramatic scenes are in some fashion easier than quieter, more interior work. I was able to get that done. The problem was that I'd somehow convinced myself that this crux moment in the novel was going to be the hard part, when in fact, because bad things happen to these good people, the second half of the novel is the hard part. And I must say it was quite painful, and there were many times working on this book and then rereading and revising it when I was weeping. There's this wonderful quote from the poet Robert Frost, who says, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." And I kept thinking about that, because I kept thinking, if this is making me feel this way, then perhaps it's axiomatic that the reader will be so there that they will feel the same.
When Laurie Moore wrote her novel, she said that after she wrote this particular event, wrote about it, she had to kind of step back for a couple of days and a few days and just kind of decompress or do something, and just didn't go back to the work for a bit. You said that you actually wept over this.
I did, and actually I didn't step back, because to the extent that part of the work of this book was to crawl inside another person every day, that is Mary Beth, who is the first person narrator of the book,
right,
and who is telling the story in the present tense, because I didn't want there to be any question of her foreknowledge of events or the reader's foreknowledge of events. She just was flung into this abyss, and I sort of had to be right there with her, and that meant the kind of vagaries of her response to events in a way that made me have to stay on top of it and not be able to step back from it.
Then, from our side of the glass, and for the reader, what do you want us to take away from the experience?
I think that sense that that all of our houses are built on sand, that we can do everything to keep ourselves safe, to keep our family safe. We can do all the right things. We can step up in every way that matters. But life is perilous.
And terminal.
Well, it is terminal, but it's also the notion that we have control is just completely illusory. It's like all those people who will say to you, you know, so-and-so has lung cancer and she never even smoked. And it's as though there was a deal with God. I'm not going to smoke cigarettes, and this is not going to happen to me. And that's not the way it happens. You know, you teach your kids to be really safe drivers, and you know, somehow magically they are. And that means exactly nothing when a drunk runs a red light and they're sitting at the intersection.
When your children were very small, when they were infants, and maybe they were in a bassinet or a crib or something, did you ever go in and find out if they were still breathing?
You know, I was just talking about this with a friend today, because I was talking about the critical moments for me. And I've got to say, that one wasn't one so much.
Uh-huh.
But there were these markers, and here's what they were. At about week two, whenever they cried, I began to wonder whether they had colic. And
right.
When they weren't up all night screaming, I said, beat that one. At about year two, I was always checking to make sure that they were making eye contact with me, because I was terrified of a diagnosis of autism. And I was lucky enough not to have that one. And at year 18, I knew that was when smart kids of a certain kind, if they were going to have mental illness, began to show some signs of it. So I had all the requisite crazinesses about the things that were most likely to spear me through the heart. But there were other mom crazinesses that I was not so nutty about, and one of them was the breathing thing. However, my second son will tell you about the morning when he limped home, having fallen asleep in someone's living room after a party and me screaming at him, "Do you know that I was ready to call the medical examiner's office and see if you were in the morgue?
Talk to the coroner." Yes.
You
dedicate the book to your children. You say, dedicate it to your children who saved my life. How?
I think... I remember myself very well when I was a teenager and in my 20s, and I think I would have been a much narrower, more egocentric, less tolerant, less pleasant person had these three people not taught me over and over again to slow down, to look hard, to back off, to open up, to be more human. I just feel like in re-experiencing life through their eyes, I got a second chance at it.
I was reading something over the weekend in which some kid said, "Whatever you say I am, that's what I'm not." And I guess that tension between us and our children is what keeps us going, in a sense.
I guess that's true, but I have to say, I think one of the great gifts of being able to have three of them was, as I think I have Mary Beth say in the novel, each occupies the place not taken up by the other.
Right.
And I think it freed up each of them to be more authentically themselves, to not feel that they had to be in opposition to us because there were different spaces open. If there was anybody who got... the whole, you know, expectation deal laid on him. It was probably the oldest. My husband and I are both eldest children, and we vowed that our eldest child would not be raised as an eldest child. And when he was about three or four, we both looked at each other and went, whoops.
Here we go. Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you this morning.
Anytime.
Novelist Anna Quinlan in conversation with Michael Enright, first heard on the Sunday edition this past May. And that's all for this first hour of the Sunday edition in the summertime. Now for the news. After that, we'll be back with the story of Fourth Line Theatre. Nestled in the farm country of southeastern Ontario, Fourth Line is a phenomenon. The little engine that could of Canada's theatre community. It is literally theatre in a barnyard, and it's been bringing local history to life for almost 20 years. I'm Karen Wells. Be back in five.